Man, Woman, and Child. From Ingersoll's Greatest Lectures, Freethought Press Association, 1944. The Liberty of Children. If women have been slaves, what shall I say of children? Of the little children in alleys and sub-cellars. The little children who turn pale when they hear their father's footsteps. Little children who run away when they only hear their names called by the lips of a mother. Little children. The children of poverty. The children of crime. The children of brutality, wherever they are, flotsam and jetsam upon the wild, mad sea of life. My heart goes out to them, one and all. I tell you the children have the same rights that we have, and we ought to treat them as though they were human beings. They should be reared with love, with kindness, with tenderness, and not with brutality. That is my idea of children. When your child tells a lie, do not rush at him as though the world were about to go into bankruptcy. Be honest with him. A tyrant father will have liars for children, do you know that? A lie is born of tyranny, upon the one hand, and weakness upon the other. And when you rush at a poor little boy with a club in your hand, of course he lies. I thank thee, Mother Nature, that thou hast put ingenuity enough in the brain of a child, when attacked by a brutal parent, to throw up a little breastwork in the shape of a lie. When one of your children tells a lie, be honest with him. Tell him that you have told hundreds of them yourself. Tell him it is not the best way, that you have tried it. Tell him as the man did in Maine when his boy left home. Johnny, honesty is the best policy. I have tried both. Be honest with him. Suppose a man as much larger than you as you are than your child, 5 years old, should come at you with a liberty pole in his hand and, in a voice of thunder, shout, "Who broke that plate?" There's not a solitary one of you who would not swear you never saw it, or that it was cracked when you got it. Why not be honest with these children? Just imagine a man who deals in stocks whipping his boy for putting false rumors afloat. Think of a lawyer beating his own flesh and blood for evading the truth when he makes half of his own living that way. Think of a minister punishing his child for not telling all he thinks. Just think of it. When your child commits a wrong, take him in your arms. Let it feel your heart beat against its heart. Let the child know that you really and truly and sincerely love it. Yet some Christians, good Christians, when a child commits a fault, drive it from the door and say, "Never do you darkness in this house again." Think of that. And then these same people will go down on their knees and ask God to take care of the child they have driven from home. I will never ask God to take care of my children unless I am doing my level best in that same direction. But I will tell you what I say to my children. Go where you will, commit what crimes you may, fall to what depth of degradation you may. You can never commit a crime that will shut my door, my arms, or my heart to you. As long as I live, you shall have one sincere friend. Do you know that I have seen some people who acted as though they thought that when the Savior said, "Suffer little children to come unto me, for such is the kingdom of heaven," he had a rawhide under his mantle, and made that remark simply to get the children within striking distance? I do not believe in the government of the lash. If any one of you ever expects to whip your children again, I want you to have a photograph taken of yourself when you're in the act, with your face red with vulgar anger, and the face of the little child, with eyes swimming in the tears, and the little chin dimpled with fear, like a piece of water struck by a sudden cold wind. Have the picture taken. If that little child should die, I cannot think of any sweeter way to spend an autumn afternoon than to go out to the cemetery, when the maples are clad in tender gold, and little scarlet runners are coming, like poems of regret, from the sad heart of the earth, and sit down upon the grave and look at that photograph, and think of the flesh now dust that you beat. I tell you it is wrong. It is no way to raise children. Make your home happy. Be honest with them. Divide fairly with them in everything. Give them a little liberty and a little love, and you cannot drive them out of your house. They will want to stay there. Make home pleasant. Let them play any game they wish. Do not be so foolish as to say, "You may roll balls on the ground, but you must not roll them on a green cloth. You may knock them with a mallet, but you must not push them with a cue. You may play with little pieces of paper which have authors written on them, but you must not have cards." Think of it! You may go to a minstrel show where people blacken themselves and imitate humanity below them, but you must not go to a theater and see the characters created by a mortal genius put upon the stage. Why? Well, I can't think of any reason in the world except minstrel is a word of 2 syllables, and theater has 3. Let children have some daylight at home if you want to keep them there. I do not commence at the cradle to shout, "Don't! Don't! Stop!" That is nearly all that is said to a child from the cradle until he is 21 years old, and when he comes of age, other people begin saying don't. And the church says don't, and the party he belongs to says don't. I despise that way of going through this world. Let us have liberty, just a little. Call me an infidel, call me an atheist, call me what you will. I intend to so treat my children that they then come to my grave and truthfully say, he who sleeps here never gave us a moment of pain. From his lips, now dust, never came to us an unkind word. People justify all kinds of tyranny toward children upon the ground that they are totally depraved. At the bottom of ages of cruelty lies this infamous doctrine of total depravity. Religion contemplates a child as a living creature, heir to an infinite curse, doomed to eternal fire. In the olden time, they thought some days were too good for a child to enjoy himself. When I was a boy, Sunday was considered altogether too holy to be happy in. Sunday used to commence then when the sun went down on Saturday night. We commenced at that time for the purpose of getting a good ready, and when the sun fell below the horizon on Saturday evening, there was a darkness fell upon the house 10,000 times deeper than that of night. Nobody said a pleasant word, nobody laughed, nobody smiled. The child that looked the sickest was regarded as the most pious. That night you could not even crack the hickory nuts. If you were caught chewing a gum, it was only another evidence of the total depravity of the human heart. It was an exceedingly solemn night. Dyspepsia was in the air you breathed. Everybody looked sad and mournful. I have noticed all my life that many people that think they have religion when they are troubled with dyspepsia. If there could be found an absolute specific for that disease, it would be the hardest blow the church has ever received. On Sunday morning, the solemnity had simply increased. Then we went to church. The minister was in a pulpit about 20 feet high, with a little sounding board above him, and he commenced at firstly, and went on and on, to about 23rdly. Then he made a few remarks by way of application, and then took a general view of the subject, and in about 2 hours reached the last chapter in Revelation. In those days, no matter how cold the weather was, there was no fire in the church. It was thought to be a kind of sin to be comfortable while you were thanking God. The first church that ever had a stove in New England divided on that account. So the first church in which they sang by note was torn in fragments. After the sermon, we had an intermission. Then came the catechism with the chief end of man. We went through with that. We sat in a row with our feet coming in about 6 inches off the floor. The minister asked us if we knew that we all deserved to go to hell, and we all answered yes. Then we were asked if we would be willing to go to hell if it was God's will, and every little liar shouted yes. Then the same sermon was preached once more, commencing at the other end and going back. After that, we started for home, sad and solemn, overpowered by the wisdom displayed in the scheme of the atonement. When we got home, if we had been good boys, and the weather warm, sometimes they would take us out to the graveyard to cheer us up a little. It did cheer me. When I looked at the sunken tombs and the leaning stones and read the half-effaced descriptions through the moss of silence and forgetfulness, it was a great comfort. The reflection came to my mind that the observance of the Sabbath could not last always. Sometimes they would sing that beautiful hymn in which occurs these cheerful lines, "Where congregations ne'er break up, and Sabbaths never end." These lines, I think, prejudiced me a little against even heaven. Then we had good books that were read on Sunday by ways of keeping us happy and contented. There were Milder's History of the Waldens, Baxter's Call to the Unconverted, Jahn's Archaeology of the Jews, and Jenkins' On the Atonement. I used to read Jenkins' On the Atonement. I have often thought that an atonement would have to be exceedingly broad in its provisions to cover the case of a man who would write a book like that for a boy. But at last the Sunday wore away, and the moment the sun went down we were free. Between 3 and 4 o'clock we would go out to see how the sun was coming in. Sometimes it seemed to me that it was stopping from pure meanness, but it finally went down. It had to. And when the last rim of light sank below the horizon, off would go our caps, and we would give 3 cheers for liberty once more. Sabbaths used to be prisons. Every Sunday was a Bastille. Every Christian was a kind of turkey, and every child was a prisoner, a convict. In that dungeon, a smile was a crime. It was thought wrong for a child to laugh upon this holy day. Think of that. A little child would go out into the garden, and there would be a tree laden with blossoms, and the little fowl would lean against it, and there would be a bird on one of the burrows, singing and swinging, and thinking about 4 little speckled eggs, warmed by the breast of its mate. singing and swinging, and the music and happy ways rippling out of its tiny throat, and the flowers blossoming, and the air filled with perfume, and the great white clouds floating in the sky. And the little boy would lean up against the tree and think about hell and the worm that never dies. I've heard them preach, and when I sat in the pew and my feet did not touch the floor, about the final home of the unconverted. In order to impress upon the children the length of time they would probably stay if they settled in that country, the preacher would frequently give us the following illustration. Suppose that once in a billion years a bird should come from some far distant planet, and carry off in its little bill a grain of sand, a time would finally come when the last atom composing this earth would be carried away. And when this last atom was taken, it would not even be sun up in hell. Think of such an infamous doctrine being taught to children. The life of a child will make the holiest day more sacred still. Strike with hand of fire, O weird musician, thy harp strung with Apollo's golden hair. Fill the vast cathedral aisles with symphonies sweet and dim, deft toucher of the organ keys. Blow, bugler, blow, until thy silver notes do touch and kiss the moonlit waves, and charm the lovers wandering mid the vine-clad hills. But no, your sweetest strains are discord still, compared with childhood's happy laugh. The laughs that fills with every light, every heart with joy. O rippling river of laughter, thou art the blessed boundary line between the beasts and men, and every wayward wave of life thine cloth doth drown some fretful fiend of care. O laughter, rose-lipped daughter of joy, there are dimples enough in thy cheeks to catch and hold and glorify all the tears of grief. And yet the minds of children have been polluted by this infamous doctrine of eternal punishment. I denounce it today as a doctrine, the infamy of which no language is sufficient to express. Where did that doctrine of eternal punishment for men and women and children come from? It came from the low and beastly skull of that wretch in the dugout. Where did he get it? It was a souvenir from the animals. The doctrine of eternal punishment was born in the glittering eye of snakes, snakes that hung in fearful coils watching for their prey. It was born of the howl and bark and growl of wild beasts. It was born of the grin of hyenas and of the depraved chatter of unclean baboons. I despise it with every drop of my blood. Tell me there is a God in the serene heavens that will damn his children for the expression of an honest belief. More men have died in their sins, judged by orthodox creeds, than there are leaves on all the forests in the wide world 10,000 times over. Tell me these men are in hell, that these men are in torment, that these children are in eternal pain, and that they are to be punished forever and ever. I denounce this doctrine as the most infamous of lies. When the great ship containing the hopes and aspirations of the world, when the great ship, frightened with mankind, goes down in the night of death, chaos, and disaster, I am willing to go down with the ship. I will not be guilty of the ineffable meanness of paddling away in some orthodox canoe. I will go down with the ship, with those who love me, and with those who I have loved. If there is a God who will damn his children forever, I would rather go to hell than to go up in heaven and keep the society of such an infamous tyrant. I make my choice now. I despise that doctrine. It has covered the cheeks of this world with tears. It has polluted the hearts of children and poisoned the imaginations of men. It has been a constant pain, a perpetual terror of every good man and woman and child. It has filled the good with horror and with fear, but it has no effect upon the infamous and base. It has wrung the hearts of the tender. It has furrowed the cheeks of the good. This doctrine never should be preached again. What right have you, sir, Mr. Clergyman, you, minister of the gospel, to stand at the portals of the tomb, at the vestibule of eternity, and fill the future with horror and fear? I do not believe this doctrine. Neither do you. If you did, you could not sleep one moment. Any man who believes it, and has within his breast a decent, throbbing heart, will go insane. A man who believes this doctrine and does not go insane has the heart of a snake and the conscience of a hyena. Jonathan Edwards, the dear old soul, who, if his doctrine is true, is now in heaven rubbing his holy hands with glee as he hears the cries of the damned preach to this doctrine. And he said, can the believing husband in heaven be happy with his unbelieving wife in hell? Can the believing father in heaven be happy with his unbelieving children in hell? Can the loving wife in heaven be happy with her unbelieving husband in hell? And he replies, I tell you, yea. Such will be their sense of justice that it will increase rather than diminish their bliss. There is no wild beast in the jungles of Africa whose reputation would not be tarnished by the expression of such a doctrine. These doctrines have been taught in the name of religion, in the name of universal forgiveness, in the name of infinite love and charity. Do not, I pray you, soil the minds of your children with this dogma. Let them read for themselves. Let them think for themselves. Do not treat your children like orthodox posts to be set in a row. Treat them like a tree that needs light and sun and air. Be fair and honest with them. Give them a chance. Recollect their rights are equal to yours. Do not have it in your mind that you must govern them, that they must obey. Throw away forever the idea of master and slave. In old times they used to make children go to bed when they were not sleepy and get up when they were sleepy. I say to them, let them go to bed when they are sleepy and get up when they are not sleepy. But you say, this doctrine will do for the rich, but not for the poor. Well, if the poor have to wake their children up early in the morning, it is as easy to wake them up with a kiss as with a blow. Give your children freedom. Let them preserve their individuality. Let your children eat what they desire and commence at the end of a dinner they like. That is their business and not yours. They know what they wish to eat. If they are given their liberty from the first, they know what they want better than any doctor in the world can prescribe. Do you know that all the improvement that has ever been made in the practice of medicine has been made by the recklessness of patients and not by the doctors? For thousands and thousands of years, the doctors would not let a man suffering from fever have a drop of water. Water they looked upon as a poison. But every now and then some sick man got reckless and said, I'd rather die than not slake my thirst. Then he would drink two or three quarts of water and get well. And when the doctor was told of what the patient had done, he expressed great surprise that he was still alive, and complimented his constitution upon being able to bear such a frightful strain. The reckless men, however, kept on drinking the water, and persisted in getting well. And finally the doctor said, in a fever, water is the very best thing you can take. So I have more confidence in the voice of nature about such things than I have in the conclusions of the medical schools. Let your children have freedom, and they will fall into your ways. They will do substantially as you do, but if you try to make them, there is some magnificent, splendid thing in the human heart that refuses to be driven. And do you know that it is the luckiest thing that ever happened for this world that people are that way? What you have become of the 500 years ago if they had followed strictly the advice of the doctors? They would have all been dead. What would have the people have been if in any age the world they had followed implicitly the directions of the church? They would all have been idiots. It is a splendid thing that there is always some grand man who will not mind, who will think for himself. I believe in allowing children to think for themselves. I believe in the democracy of the family. If in this world there is anything splendid, it is a home where all are equals. You'll remember that only a few years ago parents would tell their children to let their victuals stop their mouths. They used to eat as though it were a religious ceremony, a very solemn thing. Life should not be treated as a solemn matter. I like to see the children at the table, and hear each one telling of the wonderful things he has seen and heard. I like to hear the clatter of knives and forks and spoons mingling with their happy voices. I'd rather hear it than any opera that was ever put upon the boards. Let the children have liberty. Be honest and fair with them. Be just, be tender, and they will make you rich in love and joy. Men are oaks, women are vines, children are flowers. The human race has been guilty of almost countless crimes, but I have some excuse for mankind. This world, after all, is not very well adapted to raising good people. In the first place, nearly all of it is water. It is much better adapted to fish culture than to the production of folks. Of that portion which is land, not one-eighth has suitable soil and climate to produce great men and women. You cannot raise men and women of genius without the proper soil and climate, any more than you can raise corn and wheat upon the ice fields of the Arctic Sea. You must have the necessary conditions and surroundings. Man is a product. You must have the soil and food. The obstacles presented by nature must not be so great that man cannot, by reasonable industry and courage, overcome them. There is upon this world only a narrow belt of land, circling zigzagging the globe, upon which you can produce men and women of talent. In the southern hemisphere the real climate that man needs falls mostly upon the sea, and the result is that the southern half of the world has never produced a man or woman of great genius. It is the far north that there is no genius. It is too cold. In the far south there is no genius. It is too warm. There must be winter and there must be summer. In a country where man needs no cover but a cloud, revolution is his normal condition. Winter is the mother of industry and prudence. Above all, it is the mother of the family relation. Winter holds in its icy arms the husband and wife and the sweet children. If upon this earth we ever have a glimpse of heaven, it is when we pass home in a winter at night, and through the windows, the curtains drawn aside, we see the family about the pleasant hearth, the old lady knitting, the cat playing with the yarn, the children wishing they had as many dolls or dollars or knives or somethings as there are sparks going out upon the roaring blast, the father reading and smoking, and the clouds rising like incense from the altar of domestic joy. I never passed such a house without feeling that I had received a benediction. Civilization, liberty, justice, charity, intellectual advancement are all flowers that blossom in the drifted snow. I do not know that I can better illustrate the great truth that only part of this world is adapted to the production of great men and women than by calling your attention to the difference between vegetation in the valleys and upon the mountains. In the valley you find the oak and elm tossing their branches defiantly to the storm, and as you advance up the mountain, the side of the hemlock, the pine, the birch, the spruce, the fir, and finally you come to little dwarf trees that look like other trees seen through a telescope reversed, every limb twisted though as though in pain, getting a scanty subsistence from the miserly crevices of the rocks. You go on and on until at the highest crag is freckled with a kind of moss, then vegetation ends. You might as well try to raise oaks and elms where the mosses grow as to raise great men and women in where their surroundings are unfavorable. You must have the proper climate and soil. A few years ago we were talking about the annexation of Santo Domingo to this country. I was in Washington at the time. I was opposed to it. I was told that it was a moist and delicious climate, that the soil produced everything. But I said, we not want it. It is not the right kind of country in which to raise American civilizations. Such a climate would debauch us. You might go there with 500 congressional preachers, 5,000 ruling elders, 5,000 professors in college, 5,000 of the solid men of Boston and their wives, and settle them all in Santo Domingo, and you will see the second generation riding upon a mule bareback, no shoes, a grapevine birdle, hair sticking out at the top of their sombreros, with a rooster under each arm, going to cockfight on Sunday. Such is the influence of climate. Science, however, is gradually widening the area within which men of genius can be produced. We are conquering the North with houses, clothing, and fuel. We are in many ways overcoming the heat of the South. If we attend to this world instead of another, we may in time cover the land with men and women of genius. I have still another excuse. I believe that man came up from the lower animals. I do not say this is a fact. I simply say I believe it to be a fact. Upon that question I stand about 8-7, which, for all practical purposes, is very near a certainty. When I first heard of that doctrine, I did not like it. My heart was filled with sympathy for the people who have nothing to be proud of except ancestors. I thought, how terrible this will be upon the nobility of the old world. Think of their being forced to trace their ancestry back to the Duke of Orang-Outang, or to the Princess, of Chimpanzee. After thinking it all over, I came to the conclusion that I liked this doctrine. I became convinced of it in spite of myself. I read about rudimentary bones and muscles. I was told that everybody had rudimentary muscles extending from the ear into the cheek. I asked, what are they? I was told, they are the remains of muscles that they became rudimentary from the lack of use. They went into bankruptcy. They are muscles with which your ancestors used to flap their ears. I do not now so much wonder that we once had them as that we have outgrown them. After all, I rather belong to a race that started from the skull-less vertebrates in the dim Laurentian seas, vertebrates wiggling out without knowing why they wiggled, swimming without knowing where they were going, but that in some way began to develop, and began to get a little higher and a little higher on the scale of existence, and that came up by degrees through millions of ages through all the animal world, through all the crawls and swims and floats and climbs and walks, and finally produced the gentleman in the dugout, and from this man getting a little grander, and each one below calling every one above him a heretic, calling every one who had made a little advance an infidel or atheist, for in the history of this world the man who is ahead has always been called a heretic, I would rather come from a race that started from that skull-less vertebrate, and came up and up and finally produced Shakespeare, the man who found the human intellect dwelling in a hut, touched it with the wand of his genius, and became a palace domed and pinnacled, Shakespeare who harvested all the fields of dramatic thought, and from whose day to this there have been only gleaners of straw and chaff. I would rather belong to that race than that commenced a skull-less vertebrate and and produced Shakespeare, a race that has before it an infinite future with the angel of progress leaning from the far horizon, beckoning men forward upon such and onward forever. I'd rather belong to such a race, commencing there, producing this, with that hope, than to have sprung with a perfect pair upon which this Lord has lost many every moment of that from that day to this. Conclusion. I have given you my honest thought. Surely investigation is better than unthinking faith. Surely reason is a better guide than fear. This world should be controlled by the living, not by the dead. The grave is not a throne, and the corpse is not a king. Man should not try to live on ashes. The theologians dead knew no more than the theologians now living. More than this cannot be said. About this world little is known, about another world nothing. Our fathers were intellectual serfs, and their fathers were slaves. The makers of our creeds were ignorant and brutal. Every dogma we have has upon it the mark of a whip, the rust of a chain, and the ashes of a faggot. Our fathers reasoned with instruments of torture. They believed in the logic of fire and sword. They hated reason. They despised thought. They abhorred liberty. Superstition is the child of slavery. Free thought will give us truth. When all have the right to think and to express their thoughts, every brain will give all to all the best it has. The world will then be filled with intellectual wealth. As long as men and women are afraid of the church, as long as a minister inspires fear, as long as people reverence a thing simply because they do not understand it, as long as it is respectable to lose your self-respect, as long as the church has power, as long as mankind worships a book, just so long will the world be filled with intellectual paupers and vagrants, covered with the soiled and faded rags of superstition. As long as a woman regards the Bible as the charter of her rights, she will be the slave of man. The Bible was not written by a woman. Within its lids there is nothing but humiliation and shame for her. She is regarded as the property of man. She is made to ask forgiveness for becoming a mother. She is much below her husband as her husband is below Christ. She is not allowed to speak. The gospel is too pure to be spoken by her polluted lips. Woman should learn in silence. In the Bible will be found a description of a civilized home. The free mother surrounded by free and loving children, adored by a free man, her husband, was unknown to the inspired writers of the Bible. They did not believe in the democracy of home, in the republicanism of the fireside. These inspired gentlemen knew nothing of the rights of children. They were advocates of brute force, the disciples of the latch. They knew nothing of human rights. Their doctrines have been brutalized the homes of millions, and have filled the eyes of infancy with tears. Let us free ourselves from the tyranny of a book, from the slavery of dead ignorance, from the aristocracy of air. There has never been upon the earth a generation of free men and women. It is not yet time to write a creed. Wait until the chains are broken, until the dungeons are not regarded as temples. Wait until solemnity is not mistaken for wisdom, until mental cowardice ceases to be known as reverence. Wait until the living are considered the equals of the dead, until the cradle takes precedence of the coffin. Wait until what we know can be spoken without regard to others may believe. Wait until teachers take the place of preachers, until followers become investigators. Wait until the world is free before you write a creed. In this creed there will be but one word, liberty. O liberty, float not forever in the fair horizon, remain not forever in the dream of the enthusiast, the philanthropist and poet. But come and make thy home among the children of men. I know not what discoveries, what inventions, what thoughts may leap from the brain of the world. I know not what garments of glory may yet be woven by years to come. I cannot dream of the victories to be won upon the fields of thought, but I do know that coming from the infancy of the future there will never touch this bank and shoal of time a richer gift, a rarer blessing than liberty for man, woman, and for child.